Okay, first off, my apologies, not really, to Ayn Rand. I pronounced her name Anne. I knew after I did it that I was saying it wrong, and once in a while I will re-record a segment, but I didn't really care enough to fix it, so there. What kind of name is Ayn anyway? Plus, we gotta lighten up when people mispronounce our names. Sometimes they don't know how to fucking say it. I mean, I spell my name M-A-R-C, Mark, and I don't get upset when people pronounce it M-A-R-K, Mark. So, you know, one of my rules of life that I try to adhere to is don't be a dick. And usually I succeed, but I'm human. Sometimes I find myself kind of being an asshole for whatever reason. And I can usually course correct and maneuver myself back into non-asshole territory. But speaking of being a dick, well, let's talk about the kind of genius, kind of tormented writer Philip K. Dick and some of his movie adaptations and whatnot. He's got some great quotes. One that I can appreciate is, "It is sometimes an appropriate response to reality to go insane." Okay, well, let's get a little insane, why don't we?
You are my density. You are my density.
Okay, where do we start? Jesus, what a prolific writer. Okay, he was born in 1928 in Chicago. Wait a minute, we are starting way too early. Let's skip forward a bit. Okay, well, he died in 1982 at age 53 of a stroke. Shit, okay, that's too late. Okay, we have to settle it somewhere here. Let's start with an adaptation of his 1968 book, Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep?, which tells the story of our hero, Rick Deckard, a bounty hunter who has to kill or retire six Nexus 6 model androids led by the fearsome and intelligent android Roy Batty. Roy Batty, what a name. The novel was set in San Francisco. Hampton Fancher and David Peoples loosely adapted the book into one of my childhood obsessions, Ridley Scott's 1982 movie, Blade Runner. The movie is actually set in Los Angeles, and it stars a great Harrison Ford as Rick Deckard. It's got M. Emmett Walsh, Rutger Hauer as the lead replicant Roy Batty, Joanna Cassidy as the replicant Zora, Daryl Hannah as the replicant Pris, Breon James as the replicant Leon, and Sean Young as a replicant named Rachel that Rick falls for. The movie was well shot by Jordan Cronenwith, kind of a legendary director of photography, and his son Jeff Cronenwith famously was the director of photography for Fight Club and some other Fincher movies, and he was also the director of photography, not so famously, for the first commercial that I acted in, which was for the communications company MCI. It was a fairly big-budget commercial. It was set in the 1970s. I wore this ridiculous outfit that they gave me, and I had this terrible hair at the time. So the look kind of worked for the commercial. The director of the commercial actually met me at the editing facility I worked on. I was like assistant editing some commercial that guy directed, and he told me to come to the audition, and I went and I got it. The goddamn thing never aired, though. And it was a good-looking commercial. There was some big merger between MCI and WorldCom at the time, and the commercial kind of got killed in the process. But I think I was paid double scale, and I made a few grand on holding fees. All right, back to Blade Runner. One of the main differences between the book and the movie is that in the book, the replicants are kind of pure, unemotionless psychopaths. And in the movie, the lines between human and replicants kind of blur a bit. I think the movie still looks great to this day. The effects somehow kind of hold up. And there's a few different versions of the film, an altered ending, one and without the Harrison Ford voiceover. But I have to say, I kind of like the original version best. I'm always a sucker for like a noir type voiceover where our hero is the narrator. And for some reason, they did some marketing back in the day for Blade Runner, kind of for kids. And when I was a kid, I joined the Blade Runner fan club. They sent me some photos and some cool shit about the movie. It came with a Rick Deckard ID, some four-page report, a spinner license, which the spinners were like the flying police cars, a spinner blueprint, and a picture of Harrison Ford, and I still have that shit to this day. I was obsessed with the Voight Kampf machine in the movie, which was used to tell humans from replicants, with the immortal line from Breon James's Leon character, "Let me tell you about my mother." And then Leon shoots the investigator questioning him. Blade Runner used some great locations in L.A., including the iconic Bradbury Building, where the genetic designer J.F. Sebastian lived, and Union Station, which served as the police station. And the spinner travels through the often-filmed legendary-as-shit Second Street Tunnel in downtown L.A. And of course, Frank Lloyd Wright's amazing 1924 Mayan-inspired Ennis House in Los Feliz serves as Rick Deckard's apartment. I remember as a kid, I liked Blade Runner when I saw it, but I really dug it after I was a bit older, and it still makes me feel so weirdly comfortable to watch it. Is Rick Deckard a replicant in the end? Well, that's for you to decide. Most say yes. I prefer to think he's human, which adds a tragedy to the fact that he's in love with the robot. And speaking of loving a robot, the awesome as hell band Electric Light Orchestra has a great song entitled Yours Truly 2095, which is kind of about a robot girlfriend with just some awesome lyrics. Here's a little bit of that. She is the latest in technology, almost mythology. But she has a heart of stone. She has an IQ of 1001. She has a jumpsuit on. And she's also a telephone. And I think we're getting to the point where our girlfriends are also going to be our telephones. And anyway, the theatrical version of Blade Runner does have a kind of goofy ending where Rick Deckard and Rachel are driving in a mountainous area away from Los Angeles, perhaps towards freedom. It's kind of corny, but I grew up with this ending, so I kind of like it. Interestingly, this end footage is a mix of some hasty reshoots and some mountain B-roll helicopter footage from Stanley Kubrick's The Shining. Some people think the version known as the Final Cut is the definitive one, which is kind of similar to the director's cut. The Final Cut ditches the voiceover, has some more violent scenes, and it pushes a little bit harder on the idea that Rick Deckard is a replicant. But for me, the original theatrical version just has my heart. And if Rick Deckard is a replicant, well, he shows up in Denis Villeneuve, however you say that, his 2017 sequel, Blade Runner 2049, so I guess replicants can age. Blade Runner 2049 has Ryan Gosling as our hero, along with Harrison Ford. I found it too long, kind of lifeless, to be honest. I prefer the pulpier original. And a quote from the book, "To admit one's own addiction would be to seek and find a cure." That was my best James Earl Jones voice. Rest in peace, James Earl Jones. We will get into the inevitable topic of Philip K. Dick and drugs in a bit here. But tragically, Philip K. Dick died 4 months before the release of Blade Runner, but he was able to see some Blade Runner footage and he was completely blown away by it. Philip K. Dick was a force, and he was just one of those guys whose genius was mostly unrecognized during his life. A few months before he died in an apartment in Santa Ana, he received a check for about $50,000 for the Blade Runner movie and reportedly bought the first new car he had ever owned. I love those type of characters who keep at it. Popularity be damned. They just keep churning out material and eventually just kind of burn out. And Philip K. Dick became more famous than he could have imagined after death. Better to be famous and celebrated while you are still alive, but still, it's an accomplishment. Okay, let's move on here. I kind of goddamn love the Adjustment Bureau, loosely based on the 1954 Philip K. Dick short story Adjustment Team. It's a killer concept with Matt Damon as a politician who happens to meet Emily Blunt in passing, and then they separate. It turns out the powers that be are working to ensure people's lives proceed on a certain plan. This Adjustment Bureau keeps people on a certain path through life, and supposedly the Matt Damon character is fated to be the president, but he cannot be with Emily Blunt, who is kind of his true love. Matt Damon finds out about the Bureau, and he decides to follow his heart, and he tracks down Emily Blunt. It's a heartfelt movie. I completely fell for it, and I love the so Philip K. Dick concept of the way the members of the Adjustment Bureau are able to teleport to places using ordinary doorways. The movie is about free will and chance and our ability to alter the plan for us. In the short story by Philip K. Dick, the lead character is an insurance salesman, and in the movie, a politician. It kind of has a Twilight Zone vibe to it, some thrills, but at its heart, the movie is a love story. And it's not a Philip K. Dick movie, but the 2011 sci-fi action kind of time travel movie Source Code is another one I completely dig. It's got Jake Gyllenhaal and the great Michelle Monaghan, and I completely dig it. It was directed by Duncan Jones, a.k.a. Zoe Bowie, son of David Bowie. It's a trippy love story about Jake Gyllenhaal, who plays a soldier who is sent back in time to try and prevent a bombing. He fails, but he continues to try and gets sent back in time again. It gets a bit convoluted, alternate timelines and shit. But again, at the heart of this one is the love story between the two characters. It's kind of sad, kind of sweet, and completely my vibe. So let's touch on some more under-the-radar movies. Screamers from 1995 is based on Philip K. Dick's short story Second Variety from 1953. It was adapted by the kind of legendary screenwriter of goddamn 1979's Alien, Dan O'Bannon. Dan O'Bannon was also the co-screenwriter of the kind of awesome Blue Thunder from 1983, directed by the reliable John Badham, with my hero Roy Scheider. And Dan O'Bannon wrote and directed the completely awesome 1985 The Return of the Living Dead, the previously mentioned kind of horror punk comedy with Clue Gulager and Scream Queen Linnea Quigley. Completely fun and completely worth checking out. So yeah, Screamers is pretty low budget, but it has some energy to it. Peter Weller is the lead. He's kind of fun in it. It's got some cheesy effects. A lot of them are practical and some computer generated, which are so like amateur, but it's kind of just ridiculous and fun. I prefer goofy ass looking practical effects to computer generated shit any day anyway. It's about some weird interplanetary war. These guys are trying to negotiate a peace treaty, and these Screamers are weird mobile weapons that are burrowed in the desert, and they basically chop up anyone they deem to be an enemy. And yeah, more up-to-date versions of Screamers can assume human form, so shades of Blade Runner there. It's fun, it's got some energy, don't expect a masterpiece, but it's worth watching. It has a completely turkey of a sequel called Screamers the Hunting, but that does have Lance Henriksen, and I will almost watch him in anything. The kind of stupid, not too great movie Next from 2007 with Nicolas Cage, Julianne Moore, and Jessica Biel is about a guy who can see into the future 2 minutes at a time. Just 2 minutes? God damn it, I need way more than that. Now, for some reason, it reminds me of the kind of funny Christopher Walken sketch on Saturday Night Live where Walken played Ed Glosser, Trivial Psychic. It's like he touches someone he can see into the future, but it's like the dumbest shit ever. He, like, tells someone, you're going to buy a cup of coffee. You're going to hail a cab. And the other guy is like, does the cab crash? And Christopher Walken says, no, but you're going to leave the coffee in the cab. The guy is like, okay, I guess I'll just have to get another cup when I get here. And Walken, like, yells, look, you don't get it, do you? You're wasting coffee. And this sketch was kind of inspired by Christopher Walken's role in the movie Dead Zone, directed by David Cronenberg. Anyway, the movie Next has some fun moments with Nicolas Cage gambling in a casino, but it's largely dopey as hell. Worth a watch if you want something mindless. It bears little resemblance to Philip K. Dick's original short story, The Golden Man, from 1954, which was about a kind of simple-minded mutant who can see far enough in the future to evade capture. Okay, before we mention a couple biggies, a couple more smallies. 2001's Imposter with Gary Sinise, the ravishing Madeleine Sonneau, and my man Vincent D'Onofrio, based on the short story of the same name by Philip K. Dick from 1953. It's a sci-fi psychological thriller. Pretty well done, paranoid. Gary Sinise is a scientist who all of a sudden is accused of being an android. He's hunted down by the government. It's a little overlong, but it touches on the topics of like what's reality, what's freedom, what are memories. It's low budget, kind of faithful to the short story, and I think worth checking out. Now, a guilty pleasure of mine is Paycheck, directed by John Woo in 2003, based on the short story Paycheck by Philip K. Dick, written in 1953. It's got Ben Affleck, the always awesome Uma Thurman, and Aaron Eckhart. Affleck is a brilliant engineer. The plot involves him working on an invention to see into the future, and then his memory gets erased afterwards. The only thing he has after losing his memory is an envelope he mailed to himself full of a bunch of clues that will help him survive and defeat the mysterious henchmen coming after him. It's got some goofy action sequences. It's kind of ridiculous, and I remember I rented it at my mom's once. We watched it, and I love the stupidity of it. Like, every 20 minutes, I'd be like, this is awesome. And my mom would be like, this is terrible. So yeah, it is kind of awesome and kind of terrible, but hey, that's life for you, right? I say give it a watch. Very briefly, there's an interesting French film adaptation of Philip K. Dick's 1975 book, Confessions of a Crap Artist, which the movie was called Barjo from 1992. It's a non-science fiction story about a nerdy, obsessed main character looking for answers in his quest for the big picture. The lead character fills his notebook with dialogue, trivia, weird speculations. He's kind of an obsessive compulsive. His house burns down, and he moves in with his twin sister. It's interesting as hell, weird, but kind of worth tracking down. And tragically, Philip K. Dick's twin sister and him were both born prematurely, and his sister Jane died a few weeks after they were both born, which left Philip K. Dick with the feeling that maybe he was supposed to have died. He's actually buried next to his twin sister at Riverside Cemetery in Colorado. And interestingly, the gravestone was also inscribed with his name at her burial. And for the next 53 years, his funeral plot was secured, and just the date was added when he died. Okay, let's touch on a couple of the bigger adaptations and then close with some talk on drugs. 1966's We Can Remember It For You Wholesale is a novelette by Philip K. Dick that was adapted just into one of my favorites growing up, 1990's Total Recall, directed by Paul Verhoeven, with, of course, Arnold Schwarzenegger, Sharon Stone, the man of iron Michael Ironside, and the interesting Rachel Ticotin, who I will never forget from the 1981 movie Fort Apache, The Bronx, with Paul Newman and a kind of awesome Ken Wall as New York City cops trying to keep their integrity and decency. Rachel Ticotin plays a nurse, Paul Newman's kind of troubled love interest. She has a tragic ending, and Paul Newman's performance during her demise is just as wrenching as it gets. The movie is kind of under the radar these days, but I enjoyed the hell out of it. Okay, let's recall Total Recall. I mean, it's so much fun. Again, the usual Philip K. Dick elements. Memories, both real and imagined. Technology run amok. Mysterious assailants. Arnold travels to Mars, realizing his entire life is a false memory. And he kicks some ass along the way. But man, what a story. A totalitarian government has colonized another planet and charges ordinary people to breathe. The crazy-ass Martian red light district, cartoonish and utterly satisfying violence, dystopia, three-breasted mutant call girls, and just the utterly classic line after Arnold shoots his duplicitous wife, Lori. Consider that a divorce. I'm sure you've seen the movie, but it is worth checking out again. The remake from 2012 with the admittedly better actor Colin Farrell isn't horrible, but just lacks some charm and heart and is largely unnecessary. Unlike another remake that starred Colin Farrell, yes, I love the original Fright Night from 1985, directed by Tom Holland. It's one of my favorite movies ever. But the remake from 2011 with a fantastic Anton Yelchin and Colin Farrell as our villain was actually really well done and well directed by Craig Gillespie. Briefly, the TV series The Man in the High Castle was inspired by Philip K. Dick's book from 1962. It's a dystopian vision of America where the Allied powers lost World War II and Japan and Germany became rulers of the United States. I don't know, I checked it out during the first season and it kind of bored me. It takes a lot to get me to watch a series these days. Speaking of Colin Farrell, did you guys ever get around to watching his Apple TV noir cuckoo show, Sugar? Please do. Okay, we are slowly beginning our descent here. 1956's The Minority Report was a novella by Philip K. Dick about individuals with enhanced psychic powers called precogs who can stop crime before it can actually happen. And the 2002 film version ditched the. It's just called Minority Report, with the little-known actor Tom Cruise and the small indie director Steven Spielberg. It's also got him again, Colin Farrell, a great Samantha Morton, and just one of my all-time favorites, Max von Sydow, who played Ming the Merciless in just one of my absolute most watched favorite movies as a little kid, Flash Gordon, with Sam J. Jones as our hero, a cute Melody Anderson, and Timothy Dalton as kind of a dickhead. The football star Flash Gordon teams up with a travel agent to fly to planet Mongo and along with some Hawkmen fight to save their home planet against the evil Ming the Merciless. Shit, please watch this if you haven't. It's from, my God, 1980. One of my favorite parts is when the ruler of the winged birdmen, Prince Vulton, is flying. He's an ally of Flash Gordon, and he's going to fly down to fight the bad guys. And he says, "Oh well, who wants to live forever? Dive!" And then he flies down to fight. And I do love the whole soundtrack from Flash, which is by Queen. Here's a little bit of the song, Flash. Just a man with a man's courage, you know he's nothing but a man, and he can never fail. No one but the pure at heart may find the golden grail. Oh, Anyway, Minority Report is a big-budget masterpiece. It thrills, it's got action, it's got heart, and Tom Cruise plays the chief of the Department of Pre-Crime. How awesome is that? In the District of Columbia, where there hasn't been a murder in 6 years, but it appears there may be a murder soon, seemingly committed by Tom Cruise. The precogs are all-knowing, and although they are never wrong, sometimes they disagree. Tom Cruise teams up with the precog played by Samantha Morton. And goddamn Minority Report is just a home run. It's got star power, it's got good effects, but more importantly, it's got heart. It's ingenious, kind of noir, and just a reminder of what a great movie can make us feel like. Okay, any discussion of Philip K. Dick would be unfinished if his prodigious use of drugs wasn't mentioned. He got into some hallucinogens, but amphetamines were his thing. At least for that period where he did drugs, though he did eventually give them up. An amphetamine, speed, meth, Adderall, whatever version, dirty or clean, can be euphoric, but when abused, it can be as dark as anything out there. It can make you psychotic if you fuck with it long enough. Our brains are kind of like car engines. You go fast enough for too long, and your engine or your brain will eventually burn out. That's why such hardcore, long-time speed addicts are unable to feel any enjoyment from anything natural anymore. Their brains get used to this unholy amount of artificially induced dopamine, and the brain circuitry just eventually peters out. And you kind of rarely see older speed freaks. Generally, they don't last past 50 or 60. Their body just gives out. Being a speed freak is not a sustainable lifestyle. You either give it up eventually, or you die from it, or its longer-term health effects. And Philip K. Dick had a hell of a messy private life, divorced 5 times by the age of 45. He had some suicide attempts, 2 further marriages, and was a consistent user of amphetamines, which may have fueled his prodigious output over 40 novels and 120 short stories. But mentally, the guy was kind of a mess for a while there. And trust me, drugs can sometimes add fuel to a person's creativity, but they aren't going to make someone creative or interesting. A boring person on coke or speed is still a boring, uninteresting person. They're just talking all the fucking time about stupid things. The truly interesting person is interesting without drugs, though trust me, I do get the appeal of drugs. Philip K. Dick used enough amphetamines regularly for a while there to where he even acknowledged weeks of hallucinations. Philip K. Dick had a largely chaotic life at times, and he did eventually stop using amphetamines. There was a period of work that he did while on drugs, and a period where he had stopped the drugs. And like a targeted use of fairly low-dose amphetamine can be useful at times, but there's the rub. Most people cannot keep their usage to that level. They do a little bit more frequently, and then you find yourself fucked, my friends. The great Elliott Smith had the song Speed Trials, which I assume is about drugs, from his great 1997 album Either Or. Here's a little bit of that. It's just a brief smile crossing your face. I'm running speed trials, standing in place. It's just a brief smile crossing your face. I'm running speed trials all over the place. And let's end on the interesting movie A Scanner Darkly from 2006, directed by Richard Linklater, from the Philip K. Dick book from 1977 with the same title. The movie has Keanu Reeves as an undercover cop in a dystopian world of constant intrusive high-tech police surveillance, who becomes an addict when he goes undercover and he starts to lose his identity and is no longer able to distinguish between reality and fantasy. And I think Philip K. Dick is so relevant these days because we are approaching the world of replicants and artificially intelligent girlfriends or boyfriends, and we are almost all constantly surveilled in one way or the other by cops, by Facebook, by Apple. And slowly our reality is becoming more like the reality of reality TV, which is a bullshit reality of fantasy and Instagram and imaginary relationships. I won't get started on that shit on this episode. I promise. The world of Philip K. Dick's books is a harsh, cynical, insane world at times, and a lot of it, unfortunately, rings true to me. And in A Scanner Darkly, the lead character is becoming an addict to Substance P, the most toxic drug ever to hit the streets. And he gradually forgets he is observing himself. It's a world of paranoia and confusion. The movie is steeped in drug talk. It's a bleak world of delusion, guilt, and a lot of what really goes on when you take drugs, which is just bullshitting the time away, talking about dumb shit with other fucked up people. The movie is an interesting example of an animation style called rotoscoping. The scenes were first filmed in live action, and then animators drew on top of it. It's kind of perfect for this movie, both kind of realistic but also fantastical. And it's a cautionary tale for sure. Our hero ends up with his own self obliterated, as drugs can do that to a person. It's also got Robert Downey Jr., appropriate for a movie about drugs, Woody Harrelson, also appropriate for a movie about drugs, and Winona Ryder. It's kind of a must-see at least once. And it's funny, my buddy Charlie and I went to see this when it came out at a midnight showing. I've maybe been to 2 or 3 midnight movies. That's too fucking late, man. What was I thinking? And I will never forget, there was this girl sitting in front of us, and every like 15 or 20 minutes, she would say in the most annoying voice possible, "Nuh-uh." Like, nope, or nah, or what, you know, like that's not real or whatever. And I was like, why are you doing that? This is a movie. It's imaginary. Why are you saying that? And more importantly, please stop making that fucking noise. She eventually got up and left. I talked to my buddy Charlie once every 6 months or so. And at some point in every single conversation, I will throw in a nah-uh. And for a book completely about drugs, it's funny. Philip K. Dick was pretty much done with drugs by the time he wrote A Scanner Darkly. He said, "My writing falls into 2 degrees, the writing done under the influence of drugs and the writing I've done when I'm not under the influence of drugs. But when I'm not under the influence of drugs, I write about drugs. I took amphetamines for years in order to get energy to write. In 5 years, I wrote 16 novels. But as soon as I began to earn enough money so that I didn't have to write so many books, I stopped taking amphetamines. So now I don't take anything like that." And certainly the years of drug abuse took their toll. And as mentioned, Philip K. Dick died of complications from a stroke at the age of 53. He was forever kind of haunted by the loss of his twin sister, and he was somewhat obsessed with death and was guided by a prescient inner voice he sometimes called the Entity. It's almost like the guy could see our future, the world of virtual reality, artificial intelligence, and constant surveillance. Please check out his movies, his books, some of his interviews, and let's end with a few quotes, one a bit sad, one funny, and one a bit hopeful. Here's one that is like so relevant. "A weird time in which we are alive. We can travel anywhere we want, even to other planets. And for what? To sit day after day declining in morale and hope." Here's kind of a funny one. "I'm not much, but I'm all I have." And finally, "The true measure of a man is not his intelligence or how high he rises in this freak establishment. No, the true measure of a man is this: how quickly can he respond to the needs of others and how much of himself he can give." And believe it or not, the K in Philip K. Dick's name stands for kindred. His mother's maiden name. I mean, you can't make that shit up. So, thanks for listening, and rest in peace, Philip K. Dick.